Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, we've got the latest from Washington, D.C. on our Capitol Report, including a lawsuit filed by Public Citizen against the Trump administration, updates on cabinet appointments for the Treasury and Labor Departments, and information on the Email Privacy Act. Hear why San Diego Congressman Juan Vargas and other Hispanic caucus members are outraged over being excluded from a meeting with House members and Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials. Then learn about a bill by Congressman Duncan Hunter targeting sanctuary cities and states, and why it could cost California a lot of money. Plus, learn about the latest information scrubbed off a government website, this time info on animal cruelty cases. From Lemon Grove, we'll have a report on the city's appointments to SANDAG. Then hear why potholes are plaguing California and why the problem isn't likely to get better anytime soon. Learn why one of East County's most long-standing festivals, Borrego Days, may soon be canceled. Plus, hear why this may be the best wildflower viewing season in years coming up in the Anza Borrego Desert. Then learn about new legislation in Sacramento to protect immigrant tenants. Be sure to stay tuned for our newsmaker interview today with Walter O'Shell, a climate change scientist from San Diego State who's been studying permafrost and CO2 emissions in the Arctic, where he says he's seen climate change impacts firsthand, not only in his scientific measurements, but in researchers who used to wear down clothing and parkas and are now showing up to work in shorts while their families go wading in the Arctic Sea. And finally, on Crime Beat, hear about a home invasion robbery in Lemon Grove that turned deadly, for the robber, that is. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Gene Carpenter with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. The nonprofit watchdog group Public Citizen has filed a lawsuit against President Donald Trump. The suit challenges Trump's executive order banning federal agencies from issuing any new regulations unless they eliminate two others. A press release from Public Citizen states, Trump essentially ordered the government to stop issuing new health and safety, financial, environmental, workplace, and other vital public protections. Trump's executive order will allow big business to exploit workers, Wall Street to rip off consumers, dirty energy companies to pollute, big pharma to continue price gouging, automakers to sell dangerous cars, and on and on. The group contends that the order will make it nearly impossible for the government to carry out its duties under popular and effective laws such as the Clean Air Act, the Motor Vehicle Safety Act, and the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, warns, even after the Wall Street crash, the BP oil disaster, and other failures that resulted from letting corporations regulate themselves, the American people will be forced to suffer still more corporate recklessness and greed. Trump has said his executive order aims to cut the size of government and slash bureaucracy to help businesses thrive. The order exempts any regulations mandated by acts of Congress. But Weissman calls the requirement to cut two regulations for any new regulation a nonsensical standard with absolutely no basis in law. He calls it insidious to evaluate regulations only by considering costs to businesses while ignoring their benefits to society. Weissman warns, the executive order will mean more contaminated food, an accelerated rush to climate catastrophe, more dangerous cars and trucks, more workplace injuries and deaths, slashed consumer rights, more oil spills, more human misery, all unnecessary, all preventable, he concludes, adding, our lawsuit takes direct aim at Trump's plot to put corporate profits before people's lives and the public good.
During his campaign, President Donald Trump criticized his rival Hillary Clinton for her ties with Wall Street and high-priced speeches she gave to Goldman Sachs. He promised to protect Americans from Wall Street. But now, Trump has appointed Steven Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary. He's a former Goldman Sachs banker who later acquired a failed lender that became One West, known as a foreclosure machine for foreclosing on over 36,000 homeowners. The Senate confirmed Mnuchin by a 53-47 vote, with all but one Democrat voting against him, but Republicans pushing through the nomination. During the swearing-in ceremony, Trump claimed that Mnuchin will be a great champion for Americans who will, quote, fight for middle-class tax reductions, financial reforms that open up lending, and create millions of new jobs. But Steve Rauser, spokesman for the Main Street Business Alliance, which represents a coalition of small business owners, issued a statement calling Mnuchin's confirmation, quote, a return to the failed policies that devastated small businesses and destroyed the economy, adding, an architect of the Great Recession, Mnuchin has a track record of irresponsible economic decisions and can't be trusted at the helm of the U.S. economy. Trump has repeatedly reneged on his campaign promise to drain the swamp by appointing Wall Street executives to senior White House positions and, through the president's executive's actions, to weaken critical financial protections for consumers and small businesses, notably the Dodd-Frank Act. Democrats have accused Mnuchin of wrongfully foreclosing on many homeowners following the housing market collapse. Senator Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat from Michigan, said, Mr. Mnuchin has made his career profiting from the misfortunes of working people. One West, the bank he owned, was notorious for taking an especially aggressive role in foreclosing on struggling homeowners. An article in Vanity Fair noted that Mnuchin earned his nickname, the Foreclosure King. Mnuchin also failed to disclose in his Senate confirmation papers his position as director of Dune Capital International. That's a financial institution in the Cayman Islands known for providing an offshore tax haven for corporations or individuals seeking to dodge taxes by hiding their assets. As Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin will advise Trump on economic policies, also overseeing the Internal Revenue Service, or IRS, imposing economic sanctions on foreign governments and individuals, targeting financial assets of drug cartels and terrorist groups, negotiating tax treaties, and issuing bonds that finance government spending. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
President Donald Trump's nominee for Labor Secretary Andrew Puzder has been withdrawn due to growing opposition in Congress as well as from organized labor. Puzder is CEO of CKE Restaurants, which owns the Carl's Jr. and Hardee's fast food restaurant chains. He has opposed key labor objectives, such as raising minimum wage, and has also drawn scrutiny for revelations that he employed an undocumented immigrant as housekeeper. Multiple sources report that Puzder lacked the votes needed for confirmation by the Senate. Besides opposition from Democrats, CNN reports that at least four Republican senators opposed his nomination, and possibly as many as a dozen. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer called Puzder the worst pick for labor secretary, adding, he does not belong anywhere near the Labor Department, let alone at the head of it. Puzder's disdain for the American worker, the very people he would be responsible for protecting, is second to none. A press release from the United Farm Workers hailed the news, calling Puzder unqualified and anti-labor. The labor union statement concludes, we hope he chooses for his next nominee someone who believes in enforcing and abiding by the nation's labor laws. Now Trump has announced a replacement nominee to head up the Labor Department. Alexander Acosta will be the first Hispanic in Trump's cabinet if confirmed. The son of Cuban immigrants, Acosta has broad experience in labor and the law. Acosta is currently Dean of the Law School at Florida International University. In addition, he served as law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito back when Alito was an appellate judge. Acosta received his law degree from Harvard along with an economics degree and has also been a law school professor. He has served on the National Labor Relations Board and led the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, also serving as a U.S. attorney in Florida during George W. Bush's administration. He has served on the National Labor Relations Board and led the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, also serving as a U.S. attorney in Florida during George W. Bush's administration. Later named Assistant Attorney General, he was endorsed by the Hispanic Bar Association and National Council of La Raza. The latter stated, We may not agree with everything that Mr. Acosta has done or will do, but we are certain that he is someone who will listen and act in a fair manner. His record has not been unblemished. Critics alleged a politicized hiring process in the Justice Department during his tenure. Acosta also drew criticism for his defense of voter caging practices in Florida. Trump says Acosta is going to be a key part of achieving our goal of revitalizing the American economy, manufacturing, and labor force. Acosta's nomination has drawn praise from the head of one of the largest labor unions in the nation. Working people changed the game on this nomination, Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, said in a statement. In one day, we've gone from a fast food CEO who routinely violates labor law to a public servant with experience enforcing it, Trumka concluded. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Gene Carpenter.
This is John Fister with a Capitol Report. In today's polarized Congress, it's rare for anything to pass with unanimous support. But the Email Privacy Act, which would require law enforcement to obtain a warrant before searching or accessing Americans' emails, has passed the House with no votes in opposition. Congressman Darrell Issa, a San Diego Republican, released this statement on his vote in support. If the government wants to read your emails, then they should be required to obtain a warrant just like they would need in order to read your letters, search your hard drive, or listen in on your phone calls. Technology has made incredible advances over the years, but the privacy laws for digital communications just haven't kept pace. Right now, the rules governing how and when the government can access a person's emails, photos, documents, and other online communications are outdated and do not provide for the same Fourth Amendment protections given to on-paper or in-person communications. The bill just passed by the House is an important privacy safeguard that will help cement America's rights in the digital age. It goes next to the Senate for approval. The Email Privacy Act is backed by privacy advocates, tech industry representatives, limited government groups, and business organizations, including the ACLU, the Consumer Technology Association, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, FreedomWorks, and the Internet Association.
Several Hispanic members of Congress were kicked out of a bipartisan meeting with the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Thursday by Speaker Paul Ryan's staff, reportedly on orders from President Donald Trump. The unprecedented snub came just days after ICE abruptly canceled a meeting with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Congressman Juan Vargas, whose district includes San Diego's border region, was among those blocked from the meeting with the top ICE official. Vargas calls that action completely unacceptable. In a statement to media, Vargas states, "The Congressional Hispanic Caucus requested a meeting with the acting director of ICE because our constituents are living in fear." By being excluded, he adds, we were unable to get clear information regarding the immigration policies that are directly impacting our communities. All we want are answers. Vargas continues, children in the communities around the country are living in fear because they don't know if their mom or dad will be taken from them. Hardworking parents are fearful that they're going to be ripped away from their children. Innocent families are being targeted and separated. Our country is better than this. He says that the lack of transparency in the Trump administration is creating chaos around the nation. Relationships between community members and law enforcement are affected when immigrants are forced to retreat into the shadows because they are fearful. This administration should be transparent and tell us exactly who they are targeting and who has been detained in raids around the country. Vargas said that he and his colleagues will continue to demand a meeting with the Trump administration and ICE officials to request more information, adding, our constituents have questions and they deserve answers. Javier Gamboa, Hispanic media director for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, also denounces the action. He states, "It's wildly insulting that Speaker Ryan kicked several of his Hispanic colleagues out of a critical meeting that greatly concerns their community, especially after witnessing the fear that President Trump's deportation force has brought to Latino and immigrant communities. What's even more shocking," he concluded, "is that the speaker delivered this insult to his colleagues, apparently at President Trump's command." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery for East County Magazine on KNSJ. President Donald Trump's recent executive order threatens to withhold funding for sanctuary cities and states that seek to shelter undocumented immigrants or fail to cooperate with federal deportation efforts. Now San Diego Congressman Duncan Hunter, who represents much of East County, has announced that he will not submit any federal funding requests this fiscal year on behalf of states, cities, universities, or other entities that undermine enforcement of federal immigration laws. In a press release, Hunter states, "Sanctuaries that defy federal immigration laws should be held accountable. If a state or local entity prefers to violate the law and not cooperate on federal immigration matters, this should be an immediate disqualifier for federal funding." Despite Trump's threats, California legislators are considering a bill to declare California a sanctuary state. Some cities, such as San Francisco and Los Angeles, have already passed sanctuary language to prevent local authorities from cooperating in federal efforts to deport undocumented immigrants without criminal convictions. Now, no city in San Diego County has declared itself a sanctuary city, but the level of cooperation with federal immigration officials may vary from community to community. San Diego has turned up, however, on some lists of sanctuary cities online. So, San Diego Police Chief Shelley Zimmerman asked Homeland Security Chief John Kelly during his visit to San Ysidro last Friday just how sanctuary cities are being defined by the Trump administration, and he admitted that he didn't know. A previous bill by Hunter called the Enforce the Law for Sanctuary Cities Act was passed by the House in 2015, but it did not become law under President Obama. But now Republicans control both Congress and the Senate as well as the presidency, so Hunter's efforts to defund sanctuary cities, states, and schools could succeed. Recently, Hunter also introduced a bill to deny federal funds to sanctuary campuses, and that could include University of California and California State University schools, since both are moving to keep campuses welcoming, safe, and inclusive for all, in the words of UC Chancellor Janet Napolitano. In his State of the State address in January, Governor Jerry Brown pledged to defend everyone who has come to the state for a better life and who has contributed to the state's well-being. "I recognize that under the Constitution, federal law is supreme and that Washington determines immigration policy," Brown said, but added that states have a role to play. "California has enacted several protective measures for the undocumented," he noted, "such as the Trust Act, driver's licenses, employment rights, and access to higher education. We may be called upon to defend those laws," the governor said, "and defend them we will." So Congressman Hunter's measure could prove very costly for the state of California, cities, and public schools.
This is Gene Carpenter with the Capitol Report. Information on Animal Welfare Act violations have been taken down off the Department of Agriculture's website by the Trump administration. The action has outraged animal rights activists and consumers who rely on the information to check complaints of animal abuse, including puppy mills, horse racing, zoos, circuses, laboratories, and other facilities. Gene Bauer with Farm Sanctuary states, "Countless cases of animal cruelty have been removed and the actions and identities of abusive companies have been hidden. Citizens in our country deserve more transparency and accountability, not less," Newsweek reports. But now the Humane Society of the U.S. is fighting back. The group sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice reminding the government that under a 2009 legal settlement with the Humane Society, USDA agreed to make many records public that have since been removed. The Humane Society's lawyers have threatened to ask a judge to reopen the legal case if the matter is not resolved in 30 days. The suit was brought in 2005 to force release of records on animals used for testing in biomedical research labs.
but it would only apply to records from 2009 to 2013, not all of the missing records. However, the Humane Society also contends that removing any reports of animal abuse violates the Federal Freedom of Information Act, since it requires agencies to make information available for public inspection by electronic means. So that could apply to all of the scrubbed records. According to the USDA, the database was removed to protect privacy rights of individuals. The agency claims the people can still request documents through a Freedom of Information Act request, but that takes months or even years. Even animal researchers are objecting to removal of the data. Matthew Biley, president of the Foundation for Biomedical Research, says the change will make it more time-consuming for researchers to analyze trends in animal research. Trump's transition team at the USDA is reportedly being led by Brian Klempenstein, who heads up Protect the Harvest. On its website, the organization says its goals include informing consumers, businesses, and decision makers about the threats posed by animal rights groups and anti-farming extremists, raising the question of whether there was a political motivation to hide data from the public. Activist groups have urged consumers to contact congressional and Senate representatives asking that the USDA restore the animal welfare info that was removed. Now the public is asking that the USDA not put privacy over the welfare of animals. People are flooding congressional offices with images of their dogs, cats, and other pets with a hashtag NoUSDABlackout and stories about how the pets were rescued from puppy mills, hoarders, or other abusive situations.
This is Jonathan Getz with a report from Lemon Grove. The Lemon Grove City Council has overruled newly elected Mayor Raquel Vasquez's recommendation that she serve as the city's representative to Sandag. The recommendation was on a list of committee and agency assignments that Vasquez sent to the council. Councilmember Jennifer Mendoza pulled the item from the consent calendar. "I think Raquel did a very good job of distributing the committee assignments," she said, but added that Jerry Jones should be the city's primary representative on the San Diego Association of Governments, or SANDAG, board. SANDAG is the regional planning agency that has representatives from all 18 cities and the county, making decisions on issues such as growth, transportation, environmental and energy issues, housing, open space, air quality, economic development, and public safety. Mendoza noted that Jones served as the first alternate for over 14 years and recommended that he be named the city's primary representative to SANDAG. Mendoza added, "I should stay as first alternate," then suggested that Mayor Vasquez could serve as second alternate. "As far as I know, she's never served on a position on the SANDAG board, so the second alternate is a great place for her to come in at and educate herself," she said. Councilman Jones agreed that having him serve as the primary SANDAG representative would allow continuity and not be as subject to local elections by seating, quote, mayors who are less experienced. The mayor responded that many local government entities now have term limits that prevent people from serving on SANDAG for more than 8 years. She said, "I know that SANDAG is looking to benefit from fresh blood, and this is an opportunity to bring fresh ideas to the governing board of SANDAG." Public comment was evenly split between supporters and opponents, with two in support and two opposed. Julia Cooper spoke in favor of Vasquez, the first African-American woman elected mayor of a city in San Diego County, serving as Lemon Grove's primary SANDAG representative. Cooper stated, "We were very excited that we have this historic woman in Lemon Grove as mayor. We want her to be visible for the city of San Diego and all of Lemon Grove and the whole county to know she is mayor." Cooper, who is also African-American, concluded, "We want the representation." But Tom Clabby questioned if Vasquez's day job with the city of San Diego would present a conflict of interest. "I'm concerned that I know the mayor is an employee of the city of San Diego," he said, adding that San Diego and Lemon Grove's best interests may not always be the same. Vasquez responded that her job as a public relations representative for San Diego does not make public policy positions. "When I sit here at this platform and I represent the city, that is my sole purpose, to represent the city of Lemon Grove. As I work at my day job, I do the job as assigned." Matt Mendoza, who, like Jerry Jones, is also a Republican, joined Jennifer Mendoza and Jones in voting in favor of the revised assignments. Vasquez voted against the changes while Councilman Arambula abstained. After 14 years of being a Sandag alternate, Councilman Jones will now represent this heavily Democratic city as Lemon Grove's primary Sandag representative.
Heavy winter rains have taken a toll on roadways across California and here in San Diego County, leaving state and local governments scrambling to find funds for repairs. After failing to fund decades of backlogged repairs on state highways and other streets, California's roads are now the worst that retiring Caltrans director Will Kempton has ever seen in his 40 years on the job, the Los Angeles Times reports. The transportation system is in bad shape, he said. We have just underinvested in our transportation infrastructure for decades, and it's coming home to roost. California relies largely on gas taxes to fund transportation needs. But voters haven't passed a ballot measure increasing the per-gallon gas tax in 23 years. The flat rate hasn't risen, even though the price of gasoline has during the more than two decades that have passed since then. Democrats in the legislature are working to raise that tax over the next several years, but Republicans have opposed any tax increase, offering no alternative ideas for funding crumbling infrastructure. Here in San Diego County, roads are deteriorating in unincorporated areas, a recent survey has found. But gas tax revenues from the state to the county have gone down even as the need has risen, due in part to people driving more fuel-efficient vehicles and using less gasoline. Supervisors have recently resorted to using some general fund money for road repairs. So at a meeting last week, supervisors asked staff to identify alternative revenue sources to pay for future maintenance and roadway improvements, such as filling potholes and repaving rutted streets. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
The Borrego Days Desert Festival faces possible cancellation this year due to a shortage of sponsors, the Borrego Sun reports. The festival has taken place in Borrego Springs for the last 52 years as a tradition to welcome back snowbirds who flock to the desert each winter with a parade and other activities. But the Borrego Chamber of Commerce, organizer of the event, announced in January that due to some donors who failed to honor pledges, the event is $41,000 in debt. If no major sponsors come forward, a decision will be made in March to either postpone this year's event or cancel Borrego Days completely. Some longtime area residents still fondly recall the grapefruit days of yore, another once popular festival that has fallen by the wayside. Some newer events have sprung up in recent years, however, including the Borrego Film Festival and the Circle of Art. The chamber meets in mid-February when the community may learn if a major sponsor with a heart will step forward to save one of the community's most long-standing traditions, or if the Borrego Days Festival will disappear like dust on the desert wind. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This year's heavy rains may result in one of the most spectacular wildflower seasons in recent memory in the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park. The latest update at the park's wildflower update page states, "It's hard to predict a peak, but we should start to see lots of flowers toward the end of February. If temperatures this month continue to be mild, flowers should persist into the first half of March, at least. Of course, another rain shower or two might extend the blooming period, so our fingers are crossed. Already, plants are growing in flower fields north of town and along trails in western canyons. Desert lilies are budding in the Badlands and at the end of DiGiorgio Road. Most are not yet blooming, but when they do, they will be beautiful and fragrant. Poppies, brittlebush, and Fusilia are starting to bloom at the visitor center. You can also see spectacular pods at the north end of DiGiorgio Road. For those willing to hike a half mile up a dirt road into Coyote Canyon, San Verbena and evening primrose are starting to bloom. It's still too early for sunflowers in the flower fields along Henderson Canyon Road, however, which have not yet begun to bud. For the latest updates on where to see wildflowers before visiting, you can call the park's wildflower hotline at 760-767-4684. Reporting for KNSJ, this is Gene Carpenter.
Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher, a San Diego Democrat, is jointly authoring legislation to protect rental housing tenants from being intimidated or retaliated against because of their immigration status. Assembly Bill 291 known as the Immigration Tenant Protection Act of 2017, would prohibit landlords from disclosing information related to tenants' immigration status. It would also ban landlords from threatening to report tenants to immigration authorities, whether in retaliation for engaging in legally protected activities or to influence them to vacate. The legislation was prompted by reports brought to the Assembly Housing Committee from around the state describing incidents where landlords threatened to report tenants to immigration authorities unless they vacated immediately. But in many cases, these threats were made to retaliate against tenants for reporting habitability issues, such as exposed electrical wiring and rats, conditions landlords are legally required to fix. Threats are also made to raise rents by targeting long-time tenants for eviction based on their suspected immigration status. The legislation follows actions by President Donald Trump, who aims to deport millions of undocumented immigrants and withhold funds from sanctuary cities and states. Assemblywoman Gonzalez Fletcher says, "Every member of our community deserves the dignity of a home that is free from harassment or threats, no matter their immigration status." The Assemblywoman, who is the daughter of immigrants, adds, "Assembly Bill 291 demonstrates we won't waver away from that freedom, regardless of what Donald Trump thinks. Landlords are in possession of sensitive information about tenants, such as social security numbers, the number of people in their household, languages spoken, where they work, and when they are home. AB 291 will make sure this information is not misused by landlords and will take away one avenue that the Trump administration could use to deport immigrants." Assemblyman Chu, lead author of AB 291, says, "Tenants should not have to live in fear simply because they are immigrants or refugees. Trump has declared war on immigrants, and it is clear that ripping apart families through mass deportations could be our new reality." He says this bill will deter the small minority of unscrupulous landlords who take advantage of the real or perceived immigration status of their tenants to engage in abusive and illegal acts. AB 291 was introduced on Friday, February 3rd, and could be heard in committee after March 5th. So far, no opposition has been registered to the measure. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, listeners, we have a real treat for you. We are going to be speaking with Professor Walter Oschel. He is the Distinguished Professor of Biology, Co-Director of the Center of Climate and Sustainable Studies, and Director of the Global Change Research Group, as well as the Coordinator of the Joint Doctoral Program in Ecology between San Diego State University and the University of California, Davis. Dr. Oschel is internationally recognized as a climate change expert for his pioneering research on ecosystems and global change, including the impacts of climate change ranging from the permafrost in the Arctic to the forests of East County. Dr. Oschel, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Can you start off by telling our listeners, how did you get involved in climate science? What made you go into this field?
That's a great question. I actually did my PhD work in the deserts, in Palm Desert, on basic ecology, and then moved to Montreal, to McGill University, and worked in the subarctic in Quebec, and from there was asked to join the International Biological Program in Barrow, Alaska. So I started working by chance in the Arctic and worked at first on basic adaptation of plants to the environment, how the environment affected them, then became more interested in how plants work together with the environment as ecosystems and responded to the environment and fed back on the environment. And then in the late 70s, I realized that atmospheric CO2 was increasing, that we were looking for a long period of increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide. That would have direct effects on ecosystems. And then this in turn would cause global warming, and that global warming would have impacts on ecosystems.
Now, your findings are quite respected. I see here that you have published over 250 research papers and that your research has been cited over 22,000 times. So, listeners, if you're looking to hear from a real climate scientist, we have one here today. So let's talk a little bit about some of your work studying the impacts of the permafrost in the Arctic and why that is significant as a CO2 source.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Arctic is extremely important for several reasons. One of the main reasons is that because of permafrost, it tends to be a water-saturated environment with very little oxygen, so that the breakdown of organic matter is very slow. And over thousands of years, large amounts of carbon have accumulated in the Arctic ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the amount of carbon in northern ecosystems in the soil, in the upper meter of soil, is equal to twice that already in the atmosphere.
Okay.
So the concern was, my concern when I started this work was, if that CO2 started coming out of the upper layers of the soil, it would be a major positive feedback or reinforcement on global warming.
Right, positive in the sense that it's occurring, but really a negative for humanity in a sense.
Exactly. And then, in addition, there are large methane emissions in the Arctic. And as it warms, in areas that stay wet, as it warms, the methane emissions increase.
So are you seeing a dramatic increase in recent decades in these releases from the permafrost of the CO2 and of the methane?
Well, what we've seen is that, and is well documented, is that the system that was a carbon sink over 10,000 years is now a carbon source to the atmosphere.
And what is the cause of that?
The cause is climate change. It's a combination of the warming that's occurred in the Arctic, and the Arctic is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the planet.
So let me ask you, when we hear these climate skeptics out there, most of whom, of course, are paid for by the oil industry, but a lot of them are out there in the media, talking about climate change and saying that this is just natural cycles, that it really doesn't have anything to do with man, that, you know, this is just kind of a normal flux of things. What would your response to that be?
Well, my response would be that the climate modelers, climate scientists, are well aware of the natural forcings on climate as well as the human-caused forcings. And all of the climate models that are used and all of the climate analyses include the natural processes. And when they model climate over the last 1,000 years or so, what they find is that if they build models with only the natural forcings, and these are things like volcanic activity,
right,
dust in the atmosphere, clouds, all the things that are pointed out as being important in controlling climate, mm-hmm, if they only use those, they can quite accurately model the past climate up until the Industrial Revolution. And then as there is more and more CO2 emitted in the atmosphere.
By burning from all the factories and things, burning
exactly.
fossil fuels.
And that comes from
cars,
heating, electricity, transportation, everything that uses coal or natural gas, or diesel, or gasoline.
Okay, so when they included that in the modeling, what did they find?
Well, they found that that then the models performed not only in the past, but in the current period. So basically, you cannot explain the warming that we're seeing and have seen over the last 150 years or so based only on physical drivers, natural drivers.
And you are one of the people who's actually been measuring this. When you look at the permafrost, and the increase in
how fast it is melting or at least emitting this carbon into the atmosphere, you're seeing an acceleration. This is not the same rate that we would have seen, you know, 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago.
Yeah. No, as I said, 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago, the Arctic was a carbon sink. It's now a carbon source. And I've been working in...
So there's more coming out of it than there is going into it.
Exactly. And I've been working on the North Slope of Alaska since the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And I don't need scientific instruments to see the change that's occurred in that time. The sea ice retreat is evident. The change in the... When I started working there... it was virtually impossible to work without heavy down clothing and in perpetual fog.
Mm-hmm.
Now people are getting off the plane in shorts and t-shirts.
That's shocking.
And having 4th of July picnics on the beach and the kids waiting in the Arctic Ocean.
That's amazing.
So they're, I mean that we have the data are there, but really,
Open your eyes, don't need it.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So for the record, have you been paid on your scientific research to come up with any particular finding one way or the other on this?
I think it's more the opposite.
Okay.
It's a struggle to maintain funding to conduct the research. There are much more lucrative research areas that I could be in. This is not something you do to make money. That's for sure.
You mentioned to me you've had some very intriguing interactions with some of the so-called skeptics out there, climate change denier experts, and that you actually were involved in a panel, a debate, so to speak, about climate change with some of them. Tell me about that.
I've been involved in several debates, including on the Hill, Capitol Hill in Washington. And in one, I remember after this very intense debate and with my opponent pointing out all the flaws that can be imagined in the models and all the alternative interpretations.
Alternative facts.
Yeah, alternative facts. At the end of this debate, and there was a reception cocktail hour afterwards, he came up to me and he said, you know, you're right. I agree with you completely.
Wow.
And I said, why did you say what you said? He said, well, that's my job. That's what I'm paid to do.
So he's paid to lie.
Yeah.
Paid to lie.
Yeah.
And this is the oil industry, which is
it's
enormous.
Oil, it's natural gas, it's
coal.
Western Fuels, which is coal, has been a very big funder of contrarian information and think tanks.
And now we have the former head of ExxonMobil, which for many years was funding a lot of this climate science denial. Now he's the Secretary of State, and we have an appointee to the Environmental Protection Agency who was once suing the EPA and claims, or still is, I think, and claims to be a climate change skeptic. We're seeing the Trump administration taking down a lot of the climate change data off of the EPA website. Scientists worldwide scrambling to save the NASA satellite data. What do you think about all that?
It's very concerning, obviously. It's been a few years since we've had a president who didn't accept the facts in the associated with climate change and the attribution or the importance of human activity in causing the recent warming that we've seen.
How serious is this? I mean, if we go through 4 years or 8 years of a President Trump and nothing is done about climate change, or we start to roll back some of the things that have already happened, like the climate change accord in Paris, what does that mean for our planet?
Well, it's terrible. IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, which is pretty much the acknowledged authority on definitive statements about climate data, climate change, and has involved several thousands of scientists in the writing of the documents and analyses, came up with about 8 different scenarios of increase in CO2 in the 80s. From everything from our immediately recognizing the problem and reducing carbon emissions to our fiddle and let Rome burn attitude of business as usual, and continue to use what you want. In that 35 years since they came up with that, with those projections, we've exceeded the worst case scenario.
Wow.
So basically, our emissions are more than if we'd done nothing, if we'd done business as usual. So we've made no progress, really.
So all the wind and all the solar, it just hasn't been enough. Is that because we're seeing places like China that
a lot has to do with exporting, American consumerism around the world, and countries wanting to emulate the U.S. level of consumption mm-hmm. around the world, mm-hmm. and the fact that we're adding 1 billion people to the planet every 13 years.
Very, very.
So we have 1 billion more people every 13 years, and on average, each person emitting more CO2 than the previous year.
It seems to me that this whole climate change denial argument and this willingness of people to just believe this stuff from people who have no expertise at all or who are in the pay of the oil companies, one or the other, which seems to be the case in 100% of these so-called experts that I've checked out, and I'm sure you've probably found the same. It seems to me it's an awful lot like what we used to see with the tobacco industry in the early days when the scientists were coming out and saying, look, there's all this medical evidence that cigarettes cause cancer and other things. And, you know, we were seeing statistics, the actual increases, the more people smoked cigarettes, the more you were seeing lung cancer and all of these other things. And yet you had these paid shills for the tobacco industry going up and testifying on Capitol Hill that tobacco didn't cause cancer. And, you know, there was a certain number of people that would just believe it. I never understood that either. I mean, does that seem like a similar scenario?
It's similar, but with that model in mind, and others, I assumed it would take about 30 years from the time that climate change was recognized as a real threat to our way of life, civilization, to the planet, to the ecosystems of the planet. Mm-hmm. I figured it would take about 30 years from the time we recognized it, as it did with smoking and acid rain and air pollution and CFCs, for policy, effective policy, to be invoked. And it's taking much longer than that. We really knew everything, scientifically, we knew everything we needed to know in the early 80s to implement appropriate policy to limit climate warming and increasing atmospheric CO2. And so we're now, 36 years later, and we are not much further along in that policy. Our best shot was the Paris Agreement that now we're threatening to pull out of.
Yeah, very frightening. It seems also that we're seeing more and more alternative facts getting out there through all of these internet channels and blogs and places that are really putting forward things that really aren't true. You gave an example when we were warming up before we went on the air about the ice cube argument. Can you repeat that for our listeners?
Yeah. One of the points that conservative radio and television likes to make is that one of the projections is increasing sea level rise.
Right.
And one of the causes of increasing sea level rise is the melting of glaciers.
Massive amounts of ice,
huge amounts of ice, including in Greenland, in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And that this melting of the ice will actually increase the volume of the world's oceans and increase the sea level.
Right. Places like Coronado could just be underwater if this happens. Florida.
And what I've heard done on conservative radio and television is to start a false argument and say that scientists say that melting of icebergs is going to cause sea level rise, which...
And the analogy they use that supposedly would show that wouldn't happen is...
Well, the analogy is an ice cube floating in a glass of water. And they say, well, when that, you know, if the glass of water is full and the ice cube melts, does the water overflow? No, it doesn't. Therefore, the melting of the ice isn't going to increase the sea level.
And why is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong because if you suspended the ice over the glass and let mm-hmm. it melt, then of course the volume of the water would increase.
Right. And the ice is on the land. And listeners, this is just common sense. If you don't believe that melting ice on land can put out an awful lot of water. Just look at what's going on with the Oroville Dam up there with the massive snow melts. And, you know, we're looking at 200,000 people just had to be evacuated up there because they were worried that the tallest dam in the United States had a spillway overflow that was about to fail. So the consequences obviously can be huge. I guess it comes down to being smart consumers of information. Don't believe everything you hear. If you hear something that just sounds too odd to be true, do your research. If you're listening to conservative radio or liberal radio, go try to do some research. Find the facts yourself. What advice would you give to listeners if they want to find accurate sources, unbiased sources on something as important as climate change? How do you filter out whether something is true or might be a, you know, just a false statement?
Well, I think I would say go where the bulk of the experts are, the professionals, the practicing climate scientists, and what they're saying. The IPCC that I mentioned before has an executive summary. It's actually quite approachable.
And that stands for?
International Panel on Climate Change. It's an international group of over 1,000 scientists that periodically come out with updates evaluating both what has been happening with the climate and what's expected to happen in the future. And the summary to that is very easy to approach. But look at the credentials. Also look at how people are supported. If they're supported, you know, ultimately maybe one or two or three steps back by corporate interests, especially corporate interests associated with the fossil fuel industry.
Take that with a large grain of salt.
You might think that the information might be a bit skewed.
I want to wrap up by talking about the impacts of climate change locally, right here in San Diego County and specifically in East County. Now, you have done some research on what impact it can have on chaparral and forest environments, specifically the ones that we have right here.
Yeah.
What would you like to tell our listeners about that?
Well, we're going to see effects. Most simply, most of the climate projections are increasing temperature and increasing drought. And even if there's more rainfall, we can still have more drought if there's more evaporation.
Yeah, you can have a wet year or two, but...
You can have a wet year or two, and you can even have more rainfall. If it comes in the summer when it's not effective, or if it evaporates because it's hot, it won't be effective. But the models are pretty consistent in drought.
What's the impact going to be on our forests?
Well, I think we're already seeing it. You know, much of the Lagunas Cuyamacas that have burned are not coming back.
Yeah, I've had the Park Service people up there tell me that after 98% of the pines in Rancho Cuyamaca State Park burned, that they're fearful it will never come back as a pine forest, even though they're trying to replant, because the climate has just changed so much that it's not cold enough anymore for the pine trees
to thrive.
It's
a temperature and moisture effect. So the seedlings are not being successful. And even if they were successful, the drought causes them to be more susceptible to various diseases and insect pests. So,
yeah, we've seen tens of thousands of oak trees lost in just the last couple of years here because of bark-boring beetles that are just killing vast tracts of these oak trees that once covered so much of East County.
Yeah. I think a lot of our reserve areas are going to prove that are set aside where there are especially rich biodiversity. I expect to see the climate move out from under those, so they're no longer functional. And I think we're going to see quite a bit more frequent chaparral fires or more intense worse wildfires. Yeah.
Not something that we need here in East County that's already had the worst wildfires repeatedly in California state history. Mm-hmm. Are there things that the average listener out there can do if you're concerned about climate change? And maybe we can't control what the president does, but what are some of the actions that you recommend that individuals who are concerned about climate change can do?
I really believe in leading by example and also creating local models. The city of Chula Vista went through an extensive planning process to be able to build new houses and still meet the Kyoto Protocol CO2 emissions, which was to the emissions level of 1990, and we're very successful in that effort.
So maybe citizens could ask their local cities, for example, or their county, to take similar kinds of actions.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it can be done at the most of local levels. The other thing that individuals could do is put solar hot water on their house. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely crazy that almost every house doesn't have thermal hot water.
I had that on my old house.
It's low tech, it's inexpensive, yeah. And it's a big source of CO2 emissions on a house-by-house basis.
I had that on my old house, and I'll tell this story. One day I had an SDG&E guy come out, and he said, "We're here to replace your meter." And I said, "Well, why?" "Well, we're showing you've had zero gas usage for several months." And I walked outside, and I said, "What do you see on my roof?" "Well, a solar panel." I said, "I have solar hot water heater. Of course I've had zero usage."
Yeah. Israel can handle the technology. Many countries use solar thermal. Why aren't we doing it? The next step, of course, is solar voltaic, solar electric. And I think as people do that, they see the benefits, other people see the benefits, we can start turning the curb, getting around the corner on the issue.
Should people be voicing concerns also to their members of Congress?
Absolutely.
About what's happening at the national level?
Absolutely, yeah.
Dr. O'Shell, let me ask you this. We hear a lot of gloom and doom about climate science from some people. Do you believe that we could be reaching a point of being beyond a point of no return? Or is there still time to turn this around if governments get serious about this and take action?
I could answer that two ways. Based on our history and performance and policy over the last 40 years, I would say there's no hope and we're doomed. The other way I could answer that is if we had the right policy in place, if we demanded the right policy, I believe that with the technology that we already have, we could turn this around in a few years.
Well, that's encouraging. So there is still hope then.
There's still hope, but we have to act. We have to act decisively, and we're not doing it. So my pessimism comes from our lack of having done anything up to this point, but my optimism is that we have the technology and we could reduce CO2 emissions. And as soon as we do, that coupled with regrowth of natural lands and forests will remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And we actually could go back to previous levels of both CO2 and temperature.
Very good. Well, we're certainly going to be hopeful that the latter option is what will eventually happen and not the first. We are out of time, but I really want to thank you so much for coming in today. And listeners, you've been speaking with Professor Walter O'Shell. Dr. O'Shell is an internationally respected climate change scientist affiliated with San Diego State University and the University of California, Davis. And we want to thank you today for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
No, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Rebecca Williamson with the Crime Beat Report. A home invasion turned deadly after two men armed with pistols broke into a home on Edding Drive in Lemon Grove on Tuesday shortly before 2 a.m. One of the intruders shot and injured 22-year-old Francisco Suarez Jr. Suarez's father fired back and killed one of the gunmen. The second intruder fled in a vehicle and remains at large. Lieutenant Kenneth Nelson with the Sheriff's Homicide Detail told media that he believes the victims were targeted, but later clarified there is no evidence that the suspects and occupants knew each other. 10 News reports, Suarez was taken to a local hospital for treatment of trauma, but his injury is not considered life-threatening.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, Blues Three Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.